Giant sequoias are in some ways America's sweetheart when it comes to natural beauty in the country. The enormous trees predate us and fascinate us. People continuously flock from across the globe to see the big trees. In William C. Tweed's new book, King Sequoia, published by Heyday, he tells the story of the giant sequoia in terms of our human relationship with them. For 30 years, Tweed worked with the National Park Service as chief naturalist and a historian. Thank you for joining us, Bill.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I've read about 100 pages of your book last night, and I am so fascinated by the history behind the sequoias that you've outlined. Why the intrigue with this particular tree variety, and how has our relationship changed with these trees themselves?
Sequoias are just almost perfectly designed to fascinate us, to fascinate human beings. This took me a while to figure out when I was first working as a ranger up in the Sierra, but it occurred to me over time that the sequoias had three critical attributes that we humans just love. First of all, the sequoias are really big, and, you know, we like big stuff. If you read the literature about any place, we're talking about big mountains, big dams, big buildings, big everything. That's a human thing. We like big. And then the sequoias are old, and we are also fascinated by age. You know, sequoias live 20 to 30 times as long as human beings. I think in a way we are envious, but we are intrigued by old things, and we are even more strongly intrigued by living things that outlive us on a level of magnitude almost in terms of the difference. And finally, giant sequoia trees are rare. And of course, humans love rareness too. Why else do we watch Antiques Roadshow on PBS? We like stuff that's hard to find. And the sequoias are only found in specific places, only in California, only in the Sierra Nevada. They're very limited geographically. When you put those three together, they're big, they're rare, and they're old. You have just a perfect tree for the human psyche that allows them to affect us. I think that's the beginning of the story.
You know, in your book, there's so many elements of discovery. Can you talk to me about giant sequoia tourism? You know, my relationship with the trees dates back 20 years as a kid when I was like 4, looking up at the trees and thinking they're so tall, and then trying to hug it and like become part of the tree in some sense. So when you talk about the harm that comes to these trees, I felt devastated. Talk to me about how this giant sequoia tourism has morphed.
The sequoias have played both a positive and a negative role in our history. And in fact, you know, when I talk about this book, I keep reminding the people I'm talking to that this book isn't really exactly about sequoia trees. This book is actually about human beings and what we think about sequoia trees and what we've done to the sequoia trees and how they've affected us. Tourism is just one part of that story. It's a big part. It is now the dominant part. But the sequoias have played a big role in affecting our science. They've affected our legal structure. They've affected our land management systems. As the subtitle of the book suggests, they've simply affected the way we think about nature. It all goes back again to these three attributes, what I call jokingly the trifecta of human interest. But the trees simply make us reconsider all kinds of things. The sequoias, from the moment we first discovered them, have turned on two profound human instincts. And this was true in the 1850s, and it's just as true now, 160 or 70 years later. One instinct has always been with the sequoias, can we find a way to create personal benefit from them? Can we log them? Can we display them? Can we turn them into souvenirs? Can we whatever? At the same time, they inspire us. And in a way, the history of our relationship with the trees is a slow pendulum swinging back and forth between these two huge things. I think it is pretty indicative that the very first sequoia tree we discovered in the Sierra Nevada was cut down within a couple months of its discovery, cut down for profit. It was discovered by gold miners who were simply looking for wealth, and they said, well, here's our very big tree. What can we do to generate wealth from it? So they cut it down, cut it into pieces, and hauled it off to cities to show off the pieces to try to charge for people to literally charge a buck to see the remnants of a big tree. And what was left behind, a stump and a log, got turned into a dance floor and a bowling alley, believe it or not, on top of the log when it was plain down flat. And yet out of that came other inspirations, including the original setting aside of Yosemite as a state park in the 1860s. And we've swung back and forth between these two poles ever since. And in a way, we still swing back and forth today.
You also talk about in your book about the people that have encountered the big trees, people that have tried to exploit them, people try to make money off of them, and the real protectors. Tell me about the first real protector of the giant sequoias that you mentioned, Galen Clark.
Galen Clark is an essential figure in many different stories. He's an essential figure simply in the history of Yosemite, of course. But he, I think you can see as the first man not only to fall under the not only to be affected and captured by the sequoias, but to try to do something about it publicly. You know, he really took on the protection of the Mariposa Grove when it was simply public domain, public land that belonged in specific to no one and in general to all of us. He started out erroneously, it appears in hindsight now, to try to suppress fires in the grove in the very early 1860s because he thought fires hurt the grove, damaged the trees. He brought in tourists. He set up a hotel, but not in the grove. He set it up 4 or 5 miles away where people could stay and then go up and see the trees without doing harm to them. That was the beginning, by the way, of the complex that today is the Wawona Hotel Complex, the south entrance to Yosemite Park, something Fresno listeners, I'm sure most of them know very well. It began with Galen Clark. And he went on to have a very long life. He lived into his 90s. And served as the manager of the Yosemite Grant at the very beginning of the state park era, long before there was a national park at Yosemite. In his old age, he even wrote a little book about the giant sequoia trees to continue to get people to think about them and appreciate them. So Clark is a fascinating figure. He's buried today in Yosemite Valley. And well before he died, he picked his gravesite. And what did he do with it? He planted giant sequoia trees around it. There's now a little grove of not-so-little trees growing in Yosemite Valley around Galen Clark's grave. A very appropriate touch, I think. There are other people who go on to play very significant roles in the giant sequoia story. One, I think, a person who is very well known, but actually not generally associated with sequoias, is John Muir. And in the middle 1870s, he did something pretty amazing that changed the whole management of the Sierra and our knowledge of the sequoias. In the late summer of 1875, he set out from Yosemite. And at the beginning, you have to remember that because of the gold rush, most of the people in California were up in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta region and in the gold country, east of Stockton and Sacramento. And the trees that were known were the trees at Calaveras, big trees, and Mariposa Grove in Yosemite, but he set out to see where else there were giant sequoias trees and took this amazing 2-month-long trek across the grain of the Sierra Nevada. He was walking south, trying to stay up in the middle altitude forests of the Sierra between, 4 and 7,000 feet, crossing the canyons, climbing over the ridges, without a map, looking for giant sequoia trees. A pretty amazing walk. And what he discovered was something that had really not been understood up until that point, was that almost all of the giant sequoia trees are at the very south end of their 200-mile range. You know, the trees grow from Placer County all the way down to the south end of Tulare County. But 90% of the trees are in the southern part of Fresno and in Tulare County. Almost all the big trees are down at the south end. It was Muir who really worked that out, who wrote it up for national magazines and in scientific papers. Within 15 years of Muir's discovery, 3 national parks had been created in the Sierra Nevada, the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th national parks to be created in our nation. All of those 3 new parks contained and were inspired by giant sequoia trees. That's one of the reasons we make the claim for the trees that the national parks system as we know it really is inspired by giant sequoias. You know, to this day, every national park ranger in the United States wears sequoia cones on their hat band and their belt. Even the arrowhead emblem of the giants of the National Park Service features a giant sequoia tree. But something else came out of this. It changed Muir. Up until the middle 1870s, Muir was a correspondent, a naturalist, a writer, talking about the beauty of nature. After walking south, looking at big trees and watching the beginning of lumbering in the big trees, for the first time he began to write about how humans threaten and destroy nature. And today, the John Muir we remember, this man who worked so hard to create parks and forests and to preserve beauty, that really comes out of his engagement. The critical moment when he changed his writing and changed his whole direction comes out of that fall 1875 trip chasing big trees in the Sierra Nevada. It's a good story.
You've pondered these trees for 30-plus years. What's the moment that changed everything for you when it comes to the giant sequoia? And what do the sequoias mean to the nation?
Certainly the Yosemite Grant of 1864 was the first moment that really defined how essential powerful the sequoias are to the human psyche, although that story had begun at Calaveras after the destruction of a couple trees at Calaveras. After that, the management of Calaveras big trees was very conservative, and that remained in private hands clear into the 1930s. But no more trees were ever cut. A hotel was built, actually a hotel very similar to the Wawona that lasted until it burned down in the 1940s. And there was a time in the 1860s and 70s when the number one tourist attraction in California was the Calaveras big trees. Everybody who came west had to go see it. And then we had Yosemite. The big trees played a critical role in the Yosemite Grant. Then we had the founding of the national parks down south. Sequoia National Park, the second national park in the United States, founded in 1890. And its twin park, also established in 1890, but the name has changed. What we now call Kings Canyon, so familiar to Fresno listeners, was, of course, established in 1890 as the General Grant National Park, specifically to protect the Grant Tree and the Grant Grove of the Big Trees. A place, by the way, that was initially called the Fresno Grove of the Big Trees. And those initial groves tended to be named after their counties. We had the Calaveras Grove in Calaveras County, the Mariposa Grove in Mariposa County, and for a while we had what was known as the Fresno Grove. That was what we now call the Grant Grove up in Kings Canyon Park. So that, and for a while, even further south, there was the Tulare Groves, today what's now Sequoia National Park. There are other critical things that give different values to the giant sequoia. Some of my favorite sequoia stories have to do with science and how the trees gained new value from us in terms of giving us scientific information. The discovery, for example, that giant sequoia trees preserved climate history. A story that I enjoyed working up for the book and that has largely been forgotten, but really our whole knowledge of the climate history of the southwestern quarter of the United States, going back for thousands and thousands of years, started with a number of scientists from Yale and Arizona studying giant sequoia tree rings in areas that had been logged in the 1890s. These scientists came after the turn of the century, began looking hard at the various sizes of tree rings, and realized what they had discovered was climate history, a science we now call dendrochronology. And now in the 21st century, as we wrestle with droughts and climate change, perhaps one of the greatest things the sequoias ever gave to us was this understanding of how variable and unpredictable our California and southwestern climate is. What could be more valuable now than understanding climate history?
Let's stay on that topic for a minute. You know, John Muir and others strongly hinted that climate change has had a huge effect on the trees, and not just in recent history. What does the future look like for these trees? What's your thought? I know there's some studies going on with, like, UC Berkeley, where they're climbing the trees, you know, and taking clippings of the trees to analyze drought and stuff like that. But what do you think the future is for these trees?
I can give you two cuts on that, and they're a little contradictory, and they both are logical, because it's always hard to predict the future. Here's one point I think we can say. This is historically true. This is part of our climate change history. We know that giant sequoia trees have grown in the wettest places in the Sierra Nevada, in the southern Sierra. They're water-loving trees. They grow. What limits the groves, what determines the location of the grove, one of the critical factors is the availability of better-than-average ground moisture. This has allowed them to live through severe climate challenges in the past. For example, climate history tells us pretty clearly in the 11th century, we had a drought in California. You've read this in other contexts now. We had a drought in California with year-to-year severity about like the last couple in California, except it wasn't 5 years long. It was about 150 years long. And that's part of our climate history already. I'm not even talking yet about human-caused climate change, if that's sort of the next subject we can look at here. But this is climate history already. We know we have lots of sequoia trees standing that lived through that drought. We also know that there were huge fires in the Sierra Nevada during that drought. There was a fire, I think it was 1127, you can document it in tree rings, that burned over a huge part of the Tulare County Sierra very severely and left behind huge scars on trees that you can still date now, 800-900 years later. It's amazing stuff. And so we know that the sequoias, in a way, at least the big old trees, are very resistant to drought and able to hang in. Now, the groves may shrink. The number of trees may reduce. Lots happens to them. It's not that drought is ideal, but we have historic evidence they can survive long and difficult periods of climate change. As for what human-caused climate change will do to the trees, we also have some basic knowledge there, but of course we're a long way from knowing what the outcome of that story will be. The basic premise is this, that every 3 degrees the climate gets warmer, the plants in the Sierra Nevada are displaced by about 1,000 feet. That's the basic idea of plant zones and temperatures at altitude. Everyone in Fresno knows Bakersfield, too. When you go up into the mountains, it gets cooler. It gets cooler at a predictable rate, about 3 degrees for every 1,000 feet of altitude. Day, night, summer, winter, it works roughly like that. And the plants respond. There's a new set of plants about every 2,000 feet vertically. If you know the Sierra, you know that's roughly true. We also know that we've already seen a temperature increase in the Sierra Nevada equal to over 2 degrees now in the last century, and that's accelerating. So we've almost now done 1,000 feet of plant displacement in the Sierra Nevada. If you think that's not significant, you've got to think again, because that's the basic cause of the 66 million dead pine trees that are all at the lowest edge of the pine forest. It's having a huge effect. We're going to see that continue. That stress on the conifer forest is going to continue to push upward. It's going to push upward into the sequoia groves over time. It hasn't gotten there yet, but it will if we continue on this path. What does that mean? Well, you've hit upon a really good question. That's pretty hard to answer. But it's going to eventually lead us to a world where the sequoias are probably in the wrong places. And, of course, trees that live several thousand years are not very mobile. So the future has some big question marks.
What would you say is, like, the main reason why America loves these sequoias, and why do you?
We love these trees because they stretch our imaginations. We have to come a long distance to see them, unless you live locally, like many of your listeners are blessed to do. But people come from all over the world from long distances because they are fascinated by trees that are so old, so big, so rare. They also have another value that I think speaks to us in this era when we are so dominant on this planet, when we humans have changed so much, and that is the trees remind us to be humble. You know, when I worked for the Park Service, I was part of the team that managed Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, and that was our official legal assignment, to manage the trees, to preserve them. But after a while, it has to occur to you, when you're doing something that you're trying to manage something that lives 20 or 30 times as long as you do. And if you have any sense, you realize that the proper approach to that is profound humility, that you are trying to work with something that is longer lived, grander on an almost every scale than humans themselves. And as we do this endless thing that humans do to convert the whole planet to our immediate short-term use, which is sort of what humans do, it's good for us to remind ourselves now and then that there are life forms out there beyond us, that they live on a scale beyond us. And that's why I think the sequoias have been so influential in our culture, because they are so powerful in reminding us of things like that.
I've been chatting with retired NPS chief naturalist and historian William C. Tweed about his new book, King Sequoia, the tree that inspired a nation, created our national park system, and changed the way we think about nature. You can find the book at the Heyday website or on Amazon. Thanks for joining me, Bill.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you.